The Klingon Assault Group is a body of Star Trek fans that has come together to enjoy all things Klingon. Why Klingon? I could chalk it up to the determination that is part of the warrior spirit the Klingon race represents. I could say it was to look at reality from a different perspective, how things could have been if everybody tried hard to be their very best to each other, with Klingon honor. It could be the chance to take an existing fictional system and explore new areas about how it was created. How did the language, which we are still building on, come to be? How and why are holidays, not of this planet, celebrated? It could be a chance to envision new foods and drink. It could be a chance to cosplay, not as an individual, but in a group who has common interests together and wants to share them with the public. It could just be the first rule of CAG. Have fun. No matter what your interests are, no matter what you want to learn or be a part of developing, no matter what you do, the most important thing is to be having fun. If a hobby isn't fun, why do it? CAG offers many opportunities to have fun doing interesting things. If you like to cook, we have recipes for you. If you like making interesting drinks, we have recipes for that too. If you like to learn new languages, we have many experienced Klingon speakers within our ranks who love to share their knowledge. We even have members translating great works of fiction back to their original Klingon, and songsmiths turning pop songs into Klingon songs. If you like to learn new cultures, CAG encourages learning about Klingon culture and even developing your own aspects. Like to make costumes? CAG has guides to help you get building. If you like conventions, CAG is there. This is where we started. From showing off our work at fan tables, to running panels about the things we've learned and done, to just being the Klingons at the convention. CAG develops the tools to allow these things to happen. You can be part of that development. Join CAG. It's your duty to serve the Empire. Cup luck.
Klingon language, an invented language, started with Star Trek the Motion Picture, continued on to get us a dictionary in Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. What has it got to do with CAG? To talk about that, we have Jan Sly, or Jeremy Cohen, here from the Klingon Language Institute, who is also a member of the Klingon Assault Group, to give us some insight. Say hello, Jeremy.
Hello. And let me make one small correction. We're going to jump right into the nasty bits of Klingon. That Klingon uses both a lowercase L and an uppercase I. And in the case of my Klingon name, it's actually an uppercase I. The name is pronounced Janshi.
See, I never get these names. I was a chemistry teacher at Metro Community College. We have a license to mispronounce names.
There you go.
Why study a made-up language? I mean, we have Elvish, we have Klingon Hole, but why look at them?
So the question sort of winds up implying that we need a reason. And of course, there are plenty of hobbies out there that people have that they do for no more than their own personal recreation. So if anyone thinks they might enjoy studying Klingon, that is reason enough. But I will add that studying a language exercises your brain in an interesting way, makes it do things that it's not used to doing, makes it think about things that it's not used to thinking about. There have been all sorts of studies that say studying a language actually helps keep your memory in better shape as you grow older. And if you have an interest in some more complicated languages or real world languages, then studying something like Klingon, which is a little simpler, can be a great introduction to figuring out how to deal with languages for when you do want to study a language which will be easier to encounter in the real world.
And basically, anytime you're studying a language, the way a language is made up gives you an insight into the culture. Cultures don't say things the same way. A really good example I learned in Spanish class was Tango Hombre is the Spanish equivalent for I'm hungry, but it actually means I have hunger in Spanish.
Exactly, and we do have some interesting things like that in Klingon. On the Duolingo course just recently, I had someone complaining to me because the course presents an idiom, which in English we might say that a poem really speaks to me. But of course, the poem isn't speaking, and in Klingon instead, the typical way to say that is, the poem stabs me.
And that gets back to the warrior culture that Klingons are, giving you a view, a window, a peek into what Klingon culture is like.
Of course, yeah. And another big thing that people encounter in Klingon that challenges the way you think and the way you put together sentences in the language is that Klingon is very action-oriented. It's very verb-oriented. In English, we tend to use nouns as complete sentences sometimes. You know, you can point to a cup and say Coke, and someone will hand it to you, you know? But in Klingon, it's the other way around. You can oftentimes just ignore the nouns and just say a verb as a sentence. So Klingon is much less interested in the physical objects and much more interested in the action.
In fact, we're not doing a Klingon language course here today, but to give you an example of what Jeremy's talking about, Klingon language sets up its sentence structure slightly different in that the object that is being acted on comes first, then the action, then the person doing the action.
Yeah, that's right. If you're including a specific statement of who is doing it and who it's being done to. But if that's sort of already known, you can actually just say the verb and it is a complete sentence in Klingon implying who is doing it and who it's being done to.
Not only that, but Klingon language has the ability to add a prefix to the verb to get the I did you something.
Yeah, that's what makes it so convenient to be able to just use the verb with that prefix on. The prefix is sort of the conjugation system in Klingon. For those who have studied languages before, you may know about conjugation. And in a way, the Klingon system is easier than other languages that I've studied, but there's also a lot of prefixes. So once you have those memorized, it is so easy. But of course, the problem is memorizing all those prefixes.
I was going to say, you're making that sound so easy. I have trouble with the memorizing part.
Yeah, I think really most people, when they study languages, it's not the grammar so much that trips them up. It's the memorizing. It's nice that we have some systems out there to help you do that.
Grammar is just rules. You need those tools That's to right. apply the rules.
Yes, correct.
The main institution that fans have set up for studying the Klingon language is the Klingon Language Institute. When was it founded and why was it founded?
So let me go back just a little bit on that question and talk about the Klingon language being established as a language. The first Klingon words we ever heard in Star Trek were in Klingon the Motion Picture in 1979. And then Dr. Mark Okrand was hired to create some Klingon language for Star Trek III. And he used the Klingon that was presented in the original motion picture as a basis to build off of, but did a lot more work than was done for that movie. And he noticed people on the set kept coming up to him and asking him how to say things in Klingon. So he decided to approach the powers that be and ask them if he could publish a Klingon dictionary. And he first published the Klingon dictionary in 1985. Then, because there continued to be Klingon in movies and on TV, he did a second edition, which is basically the first edition with an addendum on it. And that was published in 1992. That same year, 1992, not directly related to the second edition, but related to the same popularity that caused a second edition to exist, the Klingon Language Institute was established.
What was the purpose for establishing it?
So the online communications existed, and fans that were learning Klingon were often isolated and alone. None of their friends or family wanted to go through the effort to learn Klingon, so they had to try to reach out and find others that were not local to them to speak Klingon to or talk about Klingon language topics with. So there were Klingon speakers reaching out to each other online and making contact with each other, having online discussions in the early days of online, a lot of it by email or on bulletin boards. And so the Klingon Language Institute was established to try and think of better ways to bring together people who wanted to study Klingon and practice Klingon and exchange ideas about the Klingon language.
On disc on the Klingon Assault Group Discord channel, there's even a channel on it that allows people to directly talk to other Klingon speakers completely in Klingon as the focus of that particular channel on the server.
Yeah, these days it's a lot easier, although many Klingon speakers are still separated and isolated, it's a lot easier to find online contact, and there's a lot of great places. The Klingon Language Institute has its own Discord server. There's an area on the CAG Discord server where you can ask questions about Klingon and speak Klingon. There are Facebook groups where people get together to talk about Klingon, and a lot of Klingon speakers on Twitter. And so there's a lot of places now where you can get together to speak Klingon with other Klingon speakers or ask questions of more advanced Klingon speakers. And to some extent, maybe the Klingon Language Institute isn't as vital to the ongoing survival of the language as it was back then. But the Klingon Language Institute still has a place to try and work on making sure those resources are well known and available. And of course, the Klingon Language Institute's big thing that we do now is the big Klingon language convention that we have every year. We call it the Kep'a, which really in Klingon just means the great meeting. But every year, the Klingon Language Institute brings Klingon speakers and Klingon learners from around the country and really around the world. We always have a few international people there so that we can meet each other in person and have live ongoing conversations, and beginners can listen to people speaking actual Klingon to each other. And until this year, when we actually did it online, and it worked better than I thought, but I really look forward to being able to get together in person with other Klingon speakers again.
One time on NPR, when I was listening, one of their commentators was relating a story. He was in Japan, in the outskirts, in, you know, nowhere near Tokyo, couldn't speak a word of Japanese. And he was standing on the train platform, wasn't exactly sure what he was going to have to do to get the right train to get him back to Tokyo. And he saw this kid walk by. The kid had a t-shirt on that said, "I speak Klingon," which the commentator also happened to do. So they conversed in Klingon to get him back to Tokyo.
Stories like that happen from now and again, but they're very rare because there's so few Klingon speakers spread so thin throughout the world. But it's exciting when you are able to find someone else who has a rare interest that you also have. And so it sounds like it was probably a very exciting story.
How does the knowledge of Klingon whole enhance a person's enjoyment of a Klingon persona?
So there's so many parts to portraying a Klingon persona and enjoying Klingon culture. And it's possible for people to get into only one aspect of that. Maybe they only like costuming. Maybe they only like the language. Maybe they only like pretending to be a Klingon. in general, though, a lot of people want to fill that out as much as they can and make that as complete as they can. And of course, if you're dressed up as a Klingon and portraying a Klingon persona, to be able to actually speak some Klingon just adds more depth and flavor and interest to that character that you've got. And so it takes a little effort to learn Klingon, and it's not for everybody. Some people will decide not to do it, but it just makes you feel more Klingon and makes other people see you as more Klingon. And as you added earlier, they're to some extent speaking the language changes the way you think about what you're saying and what you're interacting with. And so using the Klingon language actually in some small way changes the way your brain is working at that moment to be different than your normal self and allow you to enhance your Klingon character.
And in fact, there's an activity, a game, so to speak, that people can play if they know Klingon. Curse Warfare.
Yeah, Curse Warfare is very famous and popular. It's a traditional recreational activity for Klingons. The good news is that it doesn't always result in anybody losing their life or limb, although I won't say it never results in that. But the idea is it's a type of practice warfare where people aren't getting physically hurt and where you can practice the skills of your brain while doing it.
In fact, I've heard it referred to in some Klingon culture circles as a way of resolving a conflict without actually resorting to violence.
Sure, absolutely.
What's the relationship between KLI and CAG these days?
So officially, between the groups themselves, there's no official connection. They were both created separately and work separately. However, there have been plenty of cooperation between the two and events that were held in combination by CAG and the KLI together, and they both support each other real well. And in fact, the organizers of the Klingon Language Institute are all members of CAG and participate at some level in CAG. So I am a member. And of course, one of our coordinators for the Klingon Language Institute is Kurr Lakuv, the head of CAG at the moment. And so he is very interested in bringing a lot of Klingon language into CAG and having a lot of cooperation between the two.
He was just commenting either today or yesterday about the fact that he's finally gotten the chance to translate a new Klingon play.
Yeah, he really enjoys working on translations and has done a lot of great translations of songs. But what I consider probably his greatest work to date is he translated a Klingon Christmas carol with the help of some people who were involved in acting. And so it was a combined effort between people who are officially involved in plays and productions and with Kurr working on the translation with them to give it good Klingon translation. But it's a great play to see because it also translates culturally the play. And so there's some, the play is definitely recognizable for those who are familiar with the human Christmas carol, but the Klingon Christmas carol brings in some things that are interesting and really help to make it a Klingon play that's just familiar to humans. And so I think that's his greatest work to date. I am interested to see what he comes up with in this translation that he's working on now.
I believe what he's working on now is It's an Honorable Life. And what I'll say about the Klingon Christmas carol is, for those of you thinking that it's about Christmas, it's not. It's about Scrooge and his disdain for the rite of ascension.
Yeah, it rather than being a play about someone who's greedy at Christmas time, it's a play about somebody who is of questionable honorability. Some of it is still greed, but it goes a little deeper into honor than that. And it's set around a Klingon festival that he has failed to attend because he doesn't have any interest in the things being portrayed in the Klingon festival. But by the end of it, of course, as we all know how the story goes, he sees the light, so to speak, and becomes very interested in honor and duty and even fighting that happen at the festival.
So most of the Klingon translations that you're going to see, and yes, they've translated Hamlet because of Star Trek VI, and yes, they've translated Much Ado About Nothing from Shakespeare also. They catch the flavor of the human story, but they spin it into a Klingon cultural event.
Yeah, the interesting thing is Hamlet doesn't do that as much. It was one of the first plays that was translated by someone into Klingon, and they focused a little more on the language aspect of it. Of course, Shakespeare has some amazing language in his plays, and Hamlet is great. The translation of Hamlet into Klingon is great in large part because the people who worked on it worked very hard to present us jokes where there are jokes in the original and other kinds of plays on words and things like that. And so it's an amazing study in language and how Klingon can actually accomplish some great things. Unfortunately, just like modern English speakers have a lot of difficulty reading Shakespeare, it actually is complex Klingon that is not easy to deal with. And so the Klingon Hamlet is really a very advanced work. But I think since then, a lot of the work that's been done really focuses more on let's even make these things more Klingon, not just use the Klingon language.
We're going to have later on this podcast, Jen Baum is going to come in and talk about her experience with translating popular pop songs into Klingon and fitting the Klingon lyrics to the music that it has.
Yeah, there's a lot of the same problems with that in that, you know, you to some extent you have to match the rhythm and the feel while also trying to translate the ideas, if not directly, then, you know, figuring out how, you know, when two people are kissing in a song, what do you do that with Klingon? Do Klingons really kiss? We've never really seen much kissing. We've heard that Klingons bite during their mating rituals. So you wind up with something like the song Kiss Me, which I also worked on the translation for, becomes Hechop, bite me.
Which, when you first think about it, has a whole different meaning. But if you think about it in Klingon, yeah, it's what you said there, Jeremy. It's what Kiss Me would mean to a Klingon.
Right. It has that cultural shift that rather than translating the words, which might seem odd to a Klingon if they heard them, or translating the meaning so they can really understand what the song is really about.
What would you say the benefits of KLI membership is, and how do they complement or work with a KAG membership?
The Klingon Language Institute has a few things that are beneficial right now. In actuality, a lot of what's on their web page is available without a membership, but there are some special membership privileges. And the KLI offers two types of membership right now. One is a free membership. So you can actually sign up for the free membership and access a lot of what's there. And by signing up for the free membership, get notification of things that get added in the future and of events that are going on and things like that. We do have plans in place to make more resources available specifically for members. And so if you have a paid membership, which can simply be $10 a year, it's not an expensive membership, but there are additional benefits that come with that. For instance, the Klingon Language Institute webpages do have an online course. the Klingon Language Institute's online course does not have any audio, so I would recommend looking for additional audio resources. But it's a very good course, and it's aimed at the certification testing program that the Klingon Language Institute offers. There's no charge for the certification test, and you don't have to be a member, but this course will give you all the information you need to pass the level one certification. And level one certification usually happens at the conference that we have every year, the KEP-A. Again, there's no particular fee for the certification itself, but you would have to pay for membership at the conference. And if you want the online course, that comes with the $10 a year membership.
How does that course that you're talking about here on the KLI site compare with the Duolingo course now they have in Klingon?
The course that exists on Duolingo is not aimed specifically at the certification test. So it presents more grammar than is necessary for the certification test, and it doesn't necessarily include the right vocabulary for the certification test. There's a lot of overlap, but there might be vocabulary that's not on the that is on the certification test, but is not in Duolingo. And there's a lot of extra vocabulary. So Duolingo is great for learning a lot of the basics, and it does have audio. So it's a great way to hear Klingon being spoken and practice imitating good Klingon speakers. However, if your goal is to take that certification test, the Klingon Language Institute online course is much more focused on exactly what you need for that test. It does not contain anything extra. There's grammar that is not on the level one test, and so you don't really need to study that grammar, and Duolingo will make you study that grammar, but the Klingon Language Institute online course only presents the grammar that is actually on that level one certification test.
KLI and CAG seem to be a great mesh of organizations coming together, and you can kind of see that a benefit of CAG is KLI, and a benefit of KLI can be CAG, two really synonymous groups. But why don't you take us out here today with some examples of Klingon cursing, not just the patak that we hear on television, but full-blown curses that Picard gets complimented for using.
We can break down curses into three rough categories, I would say. We really have the opportunity to break it down a lot finer than that. And it's easy to make a whole course on just Klingon cursing. And in fact, at CAGCon earlier this year, I did a lecture that was more than an hour long on Klingon cursing. And so members of CAG can go to the CAGCon Discord server and find that video and the presentation I gave. But the simplest breakdown is to break it down into these sort of one-word curses, like the patak we're all familiar with. And there's some other words that are similar, todshach, ruicha. There's a whole list of single Klingon curse words that we can say. And then the next category is these standardized Klingon curses that I'll share a couple of those with you. But what I really want to point out is that there's this third category of coming up with your own curse to say at people. If you really want to get into Klingon curse warfare, you need to learn enough of the language and use your brain to come up with your own curses, because those are the ones that are best. Those are the ones that really show your mettle in Klingon curse warfare. So I encourage you all to learn some Klingon and come up with your own curses that you can throw at people. But let's talk about a couple of the standard curses that you can say. The one example of a Klingon curse would be Booj Pupbog Chov Rur Kablage. That means your face resembles a collapsed star. Another good example of a good Klingon curse would be Khosh Lit Dalokhat Chu. which means you are a total waste of energy, of good energy, I think might be even the good translation of it. And of course, the classic final nuclear option is Chab Shoshli Kuch. Your mother has a smooth forehead. A lot of the information we have on good Klingon curse warfare actually comes from an audiobook that was put out by Dr. Okren. The audiobook is called Power Klingon. I guess Power Klingon didn't do well enough to demand continued production of it, so it can be pretty hard to find these days. There are some CD variations of the book, though most of us who bought the book when it came out have it on audio cassette. I don't know if any of us even have audio cassette players anymore, but I definitely have my audio cassettes of Power Klingon. But if you can get a hold of Power Klingon somewhere, or find someone's digitized version of Power Klingon. In fact, I think the digitized files might be hidden somewhere on Chol Ampash, that's CAG's Klingon language webpage. It's at chol.cag.org, chol.kag.org. Somewhere hidden there, if you can find it, is an audio version of Power Klingon. And if you can find that, you can actually hear Dr. Okren himself saying a number of good Klingon curses that you can use, that you can memorize, but to really impress people, you can use them as a model for creating your own Klingon curses.
And one thing I think he talks about in Power Klingon is you got to be careful what you're using for a curse, because one of the curses in English is your mother wears army boots. Well, in Klingon, that's kind of a compliment. It means your mother was in the defense force, defending the empire.
Yeah, I mean, I think all the mothers on the Klingon homeworld wear army boots, don't they?
So you got to be careful what you throw at somebody. You can make up your own stuff, and there's really no explicit words in any of the traditional curses. It's just the creativity you got to use to kind of insult somebody.
I'll have to say one of my favorite curses I ever heard, and I'd have to think about exactly what they said in Klingon, but I can remember how to put it in English well enough. When I'm training the actors for Chicago's productions of A Klingon Christmas Carol, one of the things we do as part of their language training is I have them create their own curses, and we do a little Klingon curse warfare section. And the favorite one I heard at one point was somebody came up with, "Your father regrets you." It's an excellent Klingon curse.
Okay, well, I'd like to thank you for this segment here, Jeremy. So we've got more information on the Klingon language and the institutes that help us learn the Klingon language.
Thank you for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Kapla.
Kapla.
Let's continue the CAG podcast presentation of the benefits of CAG membership. One may ask, what do I get from my membership? Quite a lot when you consider the cost of membership. It's free. But seriously, let's look at all the things CAG has available to you. One thing at a time.
Now, we'd like to swing to what's available to CAG members via the quartermasters section of our group. You know, the people who make the costumes, make the uniforms, and supply the things that make you look great. And with me today is the quartermaster for CAG. Marok, I've forgotten what your rank is. Is it captain?
Brigadier General
Marok out of Chicago, and he's the head of the quartermaster section. What does the quartermaster section of CAG do?
Generally, we try to share ideas, post projects we're working on, try to find new sources for things. You know, you may not be able to find a particular prop. One of the biggest jobs I find with the quartermaster corps is finding people that make stuff and then pointing our members to them when they ask, hey, where do I find this disruptor? Hey, I'm looking for armor. Hey, I need rank pins. Who makes them? That sort of thing. Then we go and find the people either within our organization, and if no one does it, looking outside as well. There's other people in other groups that do stuff.
Yeah, that's absolutely important, because you get started on a project, any kind of costuming project, and you don't always know where you're going to find what you need to find. Patterns, what do we do with patterns?
I believe CAG has a section for certain uniform patterns and things. I know it's on, I believe it's on the CAG website itself under the quartermaster somewhere. But I do know the patterns are out there. And you can also find them online as well.
Because there's all kinds of different CAG uniforms these days, isn't there?
There is. I mean, I made up my own when I started. I used a infantry gambeson, which was medieval, but it had a Klingon look. It was black, and I threw a sash over it and rank pins, and that worked for a long time. So that's what I tell people. If it looks Klingon, it is.
So really, there's almost no wrong way to do a Klingon uniform, is there?
No, it's a personal thing. It's the type of look you want to project. I mean, if you walk in a room and you're wearing something, and this is what I always get, and people look, oh, wow, look, there's a Klingon, you're doing it right.
You talked about getting together with people who make the stuff. How do you go about doing that, and how many people do we have, and what type of projects do they make?
Well, for instance, I follow, there's another really great Facebook group called Klingon Costuming. And that's run by someone out of Minnesota. And generally, I see people there who aren't members of CAG, and I encourage them to join CAG. And I have invited a few of them, the really good craftspeople, into our group. Garrett Durr is one of them. He makes really great uniforms. And, you know, by watching these people work, you can either learn how, or you can go to them and have them either create something or at least give you information.
There's all kinds of easy and short ways to get into costuming. I mean, frankly, a few years ago, I saw that you could actually buy a T-shirt that is printed like a Klingon uniform. But I remember the first uniform that I built was taking a slightly oversized T-shirt, cutting it down the front in the middle from top to bottom, and just sewing stripes on. It's something as simple as that.
Yeah, and your other options are going to thrift stores. I wanted to do a unique-looking TOS Klingon uniform for my wife. Walked into a high-end thrift store, and here was this gorgeous crushed velour golden black uniform with a front piece that looked like the shiny sparkly stuff you would see. And I threw some emblems on it, and guess what? Instant uniform for all for under $40.
So I guess if you're going to a thrift store, look around. You never know what you're going to find that's going to work.
Exactly. You know, you just never know. And that's one of the fun things about it. You may see something, and that's where the creativity comes in.
Keeping along the lines of suppliers and or props, what non-fabric items do people have to look for when they're putting together a Klingon uniform?
All kinds of things. If it's not fabric, you're looking for rank pins, which are either going to be metal or resin or 3D printed. You're going to be looking for a belt. Oftentimes, I just buy belt blanks on eBay. You can find 3-inch leather belt blanks for $30. All you got to do is punch them. You're going to need a belt buckle that's either resin or 3D printed. And you're going to need boots. And they don't have to be expensive. You can do all this stuff yourself.
I know some people have gone to spats so they can wear tennis shoes and they look like boots because the spats cover them all the way up to the knee.
Yeah, or you can buy used boots. I found a pair of motorcycle boots for $25 that were in great shape, and all I did was drill a hole in the top to put the boot horns on and made a little armor out of aluminum for the sides, and I was ready to go. So you can do almost anything with that as long as you have the time.
Now, you just mentioned boot horns. I'm assuming that's another thing that you have to make out of a hard material, like resin or wood or something. How do you attach those to a boot?
Well, the way I did it, you can get resin or you can get 3D printed plastic ones online. What I did was I drilled a hole in the top of the boot, and it's a little tricky. Then I pre-drilled a small starter hole in the inside of the boot horn, about halfway down. And you take a washer and a screw, you reach up from the inside, and you put the boot horn on the screw and turn it down real tight. If you really want to make sure it's secure, if you're going to leave it on these boots permanently, you can put a couple drops of crazy glue on this, on the screw itself, and then just ratchet it down. That's worked really well for me.
We mentioned belt buckles and stuff. How many different types of, is there a specific type of belt buckle that you need to get, or are there just a multitude of types?
There's different ones. I mean, there's the female version, next gen version, which is a little smaller. There's the officer's version. There's the enlisted version. Then you have the TOS version. I I mean, you can get them in resin, 3D printed plastic. I'm fortunate the ones that I found on eBay when this one company called Marco Enterprises was clearing out all their stock, which was nice because their buckles are a little bit curved so they fit better. But there's all types out there. You just have to know how to attach them to a belt and then put a little latch on it.
And if I recall, you can buy the equipment to attach the resin piece or the metal piece to the belt with equipment from Tandy's. They've got the backings to attach it to the belt and actually have the hook to go with it.
Right. And I've also got one that I got from Kedar, which was rather ingenious when she was closing up most of her shop. It's a regular buckle, slightly curved. And what they did was they, when they molded these, they put two U-shaped pins in there so you could slide a belt through it and not have to do anything. So you could take an existing belt and wear this right over it.
Yeah, that always works. My first belt buckle was trying to do with Velcro, a slide over version, instead of trying to buckle it on.
Well, this one really works well because it's got these heavy metal pins cast right into the resin. But the original buckles I had the first time, I actually found myself drilling small holes in the back, putting small screws and attaching all sorts of hardware. And it worked, but it's, you know, if you're using screws and stuff, you got to be careful because it's hard on leather.
Now, you mentioned an enlisted belt buckle, a female belt buckle, and an officer belt buckle. What's the difference?
The officer's belt buckle, we'll start with, they're more gold on them around. There's a heavier edge, and they're just a little bit different. I've seen two different versions. I've seen them where the little round ball things are painted gold. I've seen them where the whole thing is painted gray. There's two versions that's shown in Next Generation. You then have the enlisted one, which has no edges on it at all, and it's completely painted silver. What's interesting is Martok has the enlisted buckle, but it's painted up like an officer's buckle. If you watch Soldiers of the Empire, he's wearing that. I actually made one of those. Then you have the female belt buckle, which we see in, what's the movie? The Undiscovered, no, not The Undiscovered Country, the movie before it. I forget the title. But there's a Klingon female officer, and she's wearing that. And so those are a little smaller, and they only have four of the little round balls on them.
Yeah, I noticed that, I don't remember if it's Lursa or Bator, had a belt buckle that was the Klingon trifoil rather than what you see members of the Defense Force wearing.
Yeah, I did see that. That's rather unique. I've seen those made. The only thing I'm wondering is how the hardware would be put on that. I've not seen that done.
Actually, what I was always wondering is, how do you bend over without stabbing yourself?
Yeah, I actually thought it might come off and become a weapon.
Yeah, I know that J.P. Butts, when he was making belt buckles, made one for himself that actually had a pair of handcuffs built into it so he could pop them out and do stuff with them.
Yeah, I've seen some of those. They're very interesting buckles.
Now, do you encourage anyone to try and make a screen-accurate original series belt buckle?
If they want to, why not?
Because it's bubble wrap?
I wouldn't use bubble wrap, but there's other ways to simulate that.
Yeah, there's ways to simulate it, but to be screen accurate, that's bubble wrap.
You can do that if you want to. I think it would be difficult. I don't think it would last very long either.
No, it didn't. If you go to the museums and look at the displays for the original series Klingon uniforms, they're deflated.
Yeah, I mean, you could probably simulate. I mean, I've looked at some different things. One of the things I was looking at using for buckles at one point was some carpet, you know, furniture glides, because they come in different sizes and they're about the right size. You can just glue those onto a piece of wood and cut it into the shape of a buckle. I mean, it's not that hard to do, but I wouldn't recommend bubble wrap.
No, it's probably not a good idea. Well, what about props, things for people to carry to make you look like the warrior when you're at a convention?
Well, you have so many different choices. Some people want to carry a disruptor. Some people want to carry a small blade or a knife or a mechleth or a batleth. I mean, that's another thing, depending upon the convention or event you're going to, how much do you want to carry? Do you want your hands free? There's such a wide variety out there.
And there's ways that people are designing their uniforms so that they can carry a batleth. Now, We got to say here that one of the rules of CAG is no live steel. So you're not going to carry around a prop made of metal at a convention.
No, you're not. And I actually know how that came about. I wasn't in CAG at the time, but we had an incident here in the late 90s, or actually early mid to mid 90s, where somebody tried to pull a real steel knife out of a Klingon's holster, and that person went to prevent them and wound up getting their fingers seriously cut. That's why we shouldn't be carrying things like that.
You even have most conventions today, the weapons dealers can sell you a blade, but it's got to go in the box and it's got to go right out to your car.
That or your hotel room. But that's true. You can't carry it on the convention floor.
But there are people that have gone and actually put a hook on the back of their uniform in the spine armor, which we haven't talked about the different methods of making that, but put a hook that they can actually carry their batleth on their back, the way you saw it carried in the Star Trek Enterprise episode Marauders.
Well, I don't know if they had a hook in Marauders. What I saw was they actually had some sort of strap on the batleth that went over the shoulder.
Yeah, in the TV episode, they had a strap. But I've seen some of the people who are doing it at conventions have gone with a hook, so it's easier to manipulate.
Yeah, it might be. I mean, in a crowd, a batleth in a crowd, you're going to have to be careful. I usually carry it in one arm. If you're around a lot of people in a crowd, that can become a problem. It can become cumbersome, too.
And you've got to remember to carry it straight up and down. You can't carry it sideways because you don't know your area of control when you make yourself wider by having a batleth.
Yeah, and if it's a wooden prop like the one I make or plastic, you're likely to scratch it up or even break it.
Well, that's no big deal. The problem is breaking the person you run into. Well,
that's the other side of it. I mean, but, I've seen props get damaged by being carried improperly too as well. I mean, aside from the safety factor, it's just not a good idea.
But then we can see that with just about any prop. Now, you threw out here that they can be made of wood or plastic. I know for a fact that you make a lot of wood ones. How do you go about doing that?
Basically, I've got plans that we've got a long time ago. I got some things from when I worked for Klingon Christmas Carol, and I made wooden forms. I'm very old-fashioned. My father-in-law was a machinist, so everything he trained me in was the old-school way. There's no laser printing, none of that here. I actually have full-size wooden patterns that we cut out. They're laid over a sheet of furniture-quality plywood. Everything's carefully stenciled out. Then everything's pre-drilled for starter holes, and everything's cut out a little bit at a time.
And you use what?
Oak or birch plywood.
Quarter inch, half inch, three-quarter inch?
I prefer the quarter inch. I've used half inch. The funny story behind that, one time I did try three-quarter inch plywood. I made two batlets for Klingon Christmas Carol to spar with. And we quickly found out that the three-quarter inch ones, when they would be practicing, they went up against someone with the half-inch ones and actually broke through them.
Well, I believe that's actually why the IKV Malota in Texas, when they do their batleth tournaments, are using three-quarter inch plywood as the base for the batleths that they're then going to put swimming noodle foam on the edges of, because that's the least likely to get destroyed.
That's true. For what we're doing it for props, theater, and stuff, you don't want to be carrying one of those heavy ones around everywhere.
You don't want to have to worry about destroying it. You don't want to be doing anything that's going to destroy it.
Well, that's true. But I found the half inch worked really well for the show. They're also easier to cut because the thicker the plywood, the harder it is to cut, and the harder it is to put the edges on. So with the half inch, we found that birch and oak plywood, I actually went through two seasons where not one batleth broke, chipped, or got damaged. And I have a couple that are almost 7 years old now, and they're still in perfect shape.
What type of other weapons do you recommend? We talked about a metlith. Have you ever tried to do a tricklith?
No, I haven't. But I have done some unusual metliths. I took a blade design from Star Trek Discovery from the first season that I liked, and I integrated it into the next generation mechlith design and came up with a pretty wicked looking mechlith.
Has anybody tried doing the new mechlith from Discovery?
I believe some of our friends up in Canada have.
Out of wood or 3D printing?
I'm not sure what materials he used. I think he used 3D printing or wood for some. It depends on what he made. He made a whole bunch of stuff.
I found some patterns for them for a 3D printer, but they're for sale, so I haven't bought any yet. I'm still on the free side myself.
Yeah, I 3D printing is great. I mean, I think it's changing a lot of stuff, but for me, I'm sticking with doing things the old-fashioned way.
Well, you've got a good shop.
Well, there's something else, too. There was a write-up about some of my work a couple years ago that I hadn't taken into consideration. They had one of the local press was at the show during our last run in 2018, and they were allowed to look over all the weapons, and what they said, you know, these look really unique because each one's just a little bit different. And that's kind of what's fun about handmade stuff versus 3D printing. The thing I like about 3D printing, if somebody needs something right away, they don't have to wait. They can go out and get it, like if it's a disruptor or some unique piece. But, you know, a batolith to me is kind of a personal thing. So you want that uniqueness to it.
Well, if you think about it as being a forged weapon, even the same blacksmith is not going to forge a blade exactly the same way every time.
No, he's not, and that's part of the thing that makes it interesting. And there's other things you can do with them. You know, once they're cut out and sanded, I usually give them a base coat of some type of primer or wood sealant, and then they get three coats of this paint called Hammered. And that stuff dries to almost a glass-like shiny finish.
Now, one thing we haven't talked about is the back of the costume. There's a spine armor component to most uniforms, unless you're wearing a command cloak, and then you're getting away from that. But how do most people go about making, or what materials do they buy spine armor in?
Well, I've had them. My sister made them for me out of different material, out of vinyl, and she put a mesh inside of them made out of some type of screen that's flexible. They've held up okay. I've seen them made out of resin. They're heavy. They're on a strap, which you can then put snaps on and attach. And I believe there's someone out there who 3D prints all the parts for that, too. I believe that's Clint out in Florida. But everybody has different materials from them. I've even seen them made out of leather.
Yeah, mine are made out of leather.
There's a lot of times you don't always have to wear them. Like you mentioned, the command cloak. I've worn the cloak over those. That's a pain. So you end up taking them off. And there's other times where you just don't want to wear them because, you know, the one drawback with any of the spine armor is stuff can get tangled up in it.
Another drawback, so if you're going to make them, make sure you're making them in a way that they're jointed and flexible. Try sitting in one that isn't flexible. And it's like a ramrod on your back.
True. That's very true. And the other thing, like I said, I had a set of resins ones that I gave to Troy a few years back. They were very, very heavy. But it was neat because they kind of rattled a bit when you walked. They were all made out of resin.
And that's surprising because I have another set of spine armor that I got through an auction from the materials that they were getting rid of from Star Trek The Experience in Las Vegas when it closed down. It's a cast set of spine armor, but it's cast in a rubbery, flexible material. So if you've got the mold to cast a set of resin armor, why not just go ahead and cast it in something that's flexible, that's bendable?
I'm sure you could. I've also seen uniforms completely made out of crafting foam, and so was the spine armor was made out of that as well.
Yeah, there's a lot of costumes today, not just Klingon, but being made out of foam, because you've got a stiffer foam that's able to be bent with heat and kept in the right shape.
Yeah, that's true. And I've seen some of that armor from one of our members in Chicago who did that. And it looks really nice. I just wonder how long that stuff would hold up and how much it lasts.
Well, if you've got somebody that's making it, have them keep track for you.
Yep, true too. But, you know, durability is something you want to look at with any costuming. Oh, and one other thing, since we're on that subject, make sure it breathes.
Oh, yeah.
I remember one of my first uniforms, my wife and I walked to Comic-Con from the hotel, which was 6 blocks away, and it was 90 degrees that day. And so we stopped to cool off, and we were both sweating, and of course, you know, a little bit of makeup. And this guy came up and said, hey, wait a minute, Klingons aren't supposed to melt. And that's when we started getting costumes that breathe.
Yeah, that's a big problem with the Star Wars costumes, is there's so much plastic on them that you're not using a material that breathes. The beauty of the t-shirt thing that I did was, well, if it's a cotton t-shirt, you got something that's going to breathe, even though the vinyl is going to be a non-breathing material, you can at least get rid of some of the heat.
Yeah, I mean, that's the uniforms that I have. Most of the armor I have is nylon strap that's spaced out and then sewn over a fabric vest. And that's worked really well. The heat goes out, it breathes, I can be comfortable in those. And they're somewhat flexible, even if they are a bit heavy. And they've lasted a long time.
Another area that picks up heat is those dang fur sleeves that everybody has. One of the ideas I had to keep cool was, instead of attaching, sewing the sleeves onto my undergarment, my t-shirt, I put snaps on my t-shirt. So now I've got a set of long sleeve fur sleeves, short sleeve fur sleeves, or like in Star Trek V, go sleeveless.
Yeah, the most brilliant example of that I saw was, I was at the KLI Kappa a couple years ago. And when I went to the Kappa, there's one night where everyone gets dressed up. And Chove had the most fantastic idea. She walked into the room, it was warm, she reached up under her vest, and she had the zippers on the top of her sleeves, and she pulled the zippers and off came the sleeves. That was one of the most brilliant things I've seen.
Yeah, I only have three snaps, so it doesn't take much of a tug to get them off.
Or you have, or your fur, like with my fur, I actually have a problem of being cold in mine because it's just the fur, there's no lining, no backing. So I end up wearing, in the winter, I end up wearing a long sleeve t-shirt under there. So I can wear the fur in the summer and it actually just, it doesn't bother me. It all depends on the materials you're using.
And another thing, since we've got a mantle that goes on our shoulders, when you're adding the stripes to your uniform, the front stripes and the back stripes don't have to come together because you're covering them with the mantle. Look at what's going to cover things so that it's not going to be seen by anybody taking your picture.
Right. When you put that top yoke on my armor, there's actually no straps there. It's just the fabric tarp type of the vest, which is reinforced with several layers. You don't see it. So why go through that? Why add extra weight and, of course, extra heat?
And extra frustration when you're sewing.
Yep. You know, the other thing, too, again, you know, I went back and most of my uniforms had vests had Velcro on them. I hate Velcro. It gets full of all kinds of stuff. It eventually wears out. What I went back and did was, there's a wonderful old school tailor down the street from me. I had her put snaps into everything.
Yeah, I have noticed snaps tend to last more than Velcro does.
They do. If you get the right kind, and you know, you can actually accent your uniform with the snaps. I actually got one, so I have one uniform that's sort of a green, sort of a brown color. I had them put copper colored snaps on there, and they really accented the uniform. I also went back because I had vinyl, you know, along the edges of the uniform strip that was coming off. I had them put pop rivets in there.
If you're looking for different types of snaps, Tandy's is a great place to look, because the leather workers have designed all kinds of snaps to be seen.
I just, I myself tend to go to a tailor. It costs me a couple bucks and they pound them right through, but you can do it yourself too. There's tools for that.
Oh, it's very easy. I've installed all my snaps. It's just a couple of things, a few whacks with the hammer in the right place, and boom, it's on, it's there, it's secure.
Yep.
So going forward, what plans does the Quartermaster's Division have, or unique ideas it might want to do?
Right now, it's just keeping people active. With everything being shut down, no events, I think a lot of people are stuck at home or starting to turn to making stuff while they have time. It's encouraging people to do that. That's been my main focus, has been trying to post things. I myself hadn't made anything in months. All the way through, I want to say I shut down in March because people weren't interested in things and I had a lot of inventory sitting around. I didn't need anything for myself, so I kind of put everything on hold. And now I'm just starting to make other things because we had a bunch of trees chopped down in the front yard, and I took all those pieces and chopped them up and started making mechlet stands, batlet stands, and things like that out of the pieces of the tree. So I'm hoping people are doing that. I'm also looking for other talent to bring into the group, so that people can see the type of stuff they're doing, because I have a feeling a lot more people right now are home crafting.
I really hope that's the case. Otherwise, they're all going to go stir crazy and they're going to be marching with pitchforks after us.
Well, that's just it. You know, you want to, and the other thing is, like with me, the stuff I'm making now, I want to have enough stuff made ahead of time for when people ask for something while I have the time to do it. And this is a good time to go into your costume rooms, closets, whatever, pull out that stuff that you've been, you know, oh, I'm going to work on that someday. This is the time to do it. You have the time now. There's no conventions, no major events. You know, that stuff that you put on the back burner, now is the time to go finish it. And that's what we're here for. Ask questions. You know, there's other crafters out there if you're not sure how to do something. And hey, you know what? Same thing like I do at work. If I don't know the answer, I know who does. And I will point you in that direction. And that's the whole point of having a quartermaster corps.
That's one of the main benefits of having that quartermaster corps. These people know how it's done. These people are resources you can go to and get the help and information that you need to accomplish that project that you want to do. I'd like to thank you, Brigadier, and we really appreciate your time talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Really though, when you're looking at your benefits, they will be determined by what you contribute, what you do, and how much you're willing to learn. In other words, what you get from CAG will depend on what you're willing to put into CAG. We hope this series of podcasts has whetted your appetite for doing things and left you wanting more. Ideally, if you don't find what you're looking for in CAG, help us create it for you. And remember, above all else, have fun. Cup luck.